Last time I began by saying that I would talk about the most important topic I could possibly talk about. And I don't know how many of you were disappointed when I then said, I'm going to talk about how to sustain and deepen daily life practice. And I would still stand by that original suggestion that there's a way in which we can have wonderful experiences, we can have moments of clarity or calm, we can be at a retreat where we have sustained bliss, and yet the bulk of our lives is spent outside of formal practice. And our love, our wisdom, our courage, our generosity has to manifest in the entirety of our lives. And I believe that there's a kind of a cultural evolutionary imperative pointing towards a new sense of spiritual practice, which might have depths of insight and awareness and manifest in the midst of daily life. I think many of us feel called to that, but we don't quite know how to do that. Many of us feel called to degrees of depth that may not always be there, and how to have that more in daily life. And I think that we as teachers don't know so well how to guide that necessarily. I think we're quite good for retreats, and we try our best with daily life, but I don't know that we've really helped to give the guidance that would go to the level of depth that I think many of us feel called to go to. And it's been an interest of mine, and as I mentioned last time, particularly after doing longer retreats, to ask how can some of the depths, and not that retreats only have depths, of course, but that some of the levels of awareness or clarity or insight or energy, how can those be more and more present and more stabilized in daily life. And towards the end of exploring that, and I think in a way we're all exploring that together, I think it's quite a collaborative undertaking, how to do this. And, you know, as we saw last time when I asked what for you helps you, we had a lot of wonderful suggestions that people have been using in their daily lives. And I think maybe in 20 or 50 years, we'll have a kind of a compilation of that that will be available. And we'll look back, oh boy, in the first part of the, you know, this millennium, people kind of had it rough. They didn't quite know all these ways to make it real in daily life. And they were kind of doing their best, but, oh. And so, So last time, I particularly mentioned what we could call three levels of deepening daily life practice, what I called foundational, intermediate, and more advanced, acknowledging that some of the practices that I put in the intermediate or advanced categories could be elsewhere, a little bit arbitrary as to the placement. And then I invited people to choose one or two ways to deepen your practice, maybe to do something that you hadn't done before, or maybe do something that you had done before, but do it more regularly. And at least last week, it seemed like almost all the hands went up in terms of people saying they would do that. And so let me just ask, how many people had worked with that some, at least? Worked with it some, let's put it that way. Okay, very good. And how many of you were not here last time?
Oh.
Okay, good. Okay, so what I'll do is I wanted to give a brief review of those three levels of practice and some sample practices. And I wanted to go into more depth. And this was what was, I think, the suggestion from you all last time. Go into more depth on a few key areas. And I'd like to, again, invite you, as we talk together, to consider having the intention to keep your practice of choosing one or two areas going next week, at least till next week. I'd like to invite that, and I'll, towards the end, I'll do something like what we did last time and ask people to actually reflect on what you'd like to do, if this resonates with you. The foundational level, especially I'm talking now for people who weren't there, is what you often might hear in talks, and particularly if you go to retreats at the end of a retreat. There are certain basic ways to deepen practice that are more what we do initially. Of course, we have to keep on doing them, so for a lot of us, we have to keep coming back. But they are the development, they include the development of a daily practice. They involve some way that we ground further in clarity about what we're doing, having a clear perspective, what we in Buddhist circles call right view or right understanding. This might involve reading, listening to Dharma talks, listening to talks, having a better sense of the core intentions of our practice. We would also ground more fully ethically. We would take on the ethical precepts. We might even work with them regularly. In some Buddhist communities that I visited, people actually meditate together, and they would actually remember at least once a week the core ethical precepts. At the Wednesday morning gathering that I teach along with Sylvia Borstein, we used to have people come early and renew the ethical precepts once a month. And for various reasons, which I think are not connected with our ethical competence, we're not doing that now. So I may come back to that. I think it was the early morning and the relatively few number of people who came, I think that was, and Sylvia getting a little older. Okay, that was confidential. Confidential comment, so, okay. What? Okay, we won't post that on the web. Okay. Nope, she would say so, but it's a little sensitive. Okay. Was that wise speech? Okay. So, then another foundational way to deepen practice is to connect with groups, have support of various kinds, particularly with a group, a community, peers, a friend. We might also start retreats and start to go have more sustained practice. We might start doing day-longs. Retreats and so forth. So I call that the foundational level. At an intermediate level, we will have learned a number of practices, and we have this complementary set of practices which really get at different parts of our being. So we have mindfulness practice, we have heart practices, we have ways to cultivate wisdom more deeply and insight. We may also be linking that with psychological work, which gets at some material that the meditation doesn't always get at fully. Some of the work that I do with judgmental mind might fit in that category. We start really looking at the wholeness of our being and seeing where we are stuck, underdeveloped, and so forth, and bring that in. We might also, at this point, really ask a question, what are my priorities? And I mentioned how in at this intermediate level, I mentioned how in a lot of the one-on-one work that I do with people, asking questions about what's important, am I really living the way I want to live, become crucial. You know, we may come to that with reflections. In many traditions, there's reflection on impermanence and even death as ways to enliven us. You know, retreats are wonderful for being able to ask, what are my priorities? And am I caught up in things that keep me busy and a little distracted? So clarifying priorities becomes very important. A beautiful poem which expresses some of this feeling from Hafiz, the Sufi poet. We have not come here to take prisoners, he says, but to surrender ever more deeply to freedom and joy. We have not come into this exquisite world to hold ourselves hostage from love. Run, my dear, from anything that may not strengthen your precious budding wings. Run like hell, my dear, from anyone likely to put a sharp knife into the sacred, tender vision of your beautiful heart. It's really about priorities, you know, and what am I doing? And life is short, and so forth. And that, again, that could be intermediate, could be advanced, and we may look at it at different ways. We may work further with intentions at this intermediate level. I'm going to come back and talk about intentions. It was a request from last time. We may really work to have ways that our practice comes into more and more of the parts of our lives and that we touch with these deeper aspirations more and more. And I'll come back to that. We may also start to take difficulties and challenges as key parts of our practice. And I'm going to come back to that point as well. You know, that I mentioned last time the Tibetan Lojong teaching, take all obstacles as the path of practice. That changes everything. It changes everything. And I quoted from another Tibetan saying, was it when the sun is shining and my belly is full, I look like a good Dharma practitioner. But when difficulties arise, then my faults are exposed. So very, very related to that. And we start filling out our lives with more support, basically. You know, we might find our friends changing, which can be challenging, and we might say, I want to be more with these friends who share my values. Right? Can be a difficult aspect of practice. We may come to groups more. I know when I was first practicing, I was living in Boston, and I actually went to different groups. I went to 3, 4, 5 groups a week. I really, you know, it was great to have that opportunity, and we have that opportunity around here. You could do that, you know, if that works with your life. And I was a student in my 20s, so it worked. You know, and we also may start finding ways that we want to have our environment support our practice. I mentioned how coming from many retreats, I've had this deep urge to beautify my environment around me. I like the phrase interior decoration as a way to express that intention and also to maybe get at the essence of meditation, which is another kind of interior decoration. Right. And so I may start finding ways to support myself through working with both the external environment and actually having more practice times. And that really gets me to the more advanced practices, one of which I think there, again, this could be a more intermediate, but I think there, particularly in this culture, there's a further grounding in the body, which is really crucial. I'm going to come back to that point. point, because it's really, really crucial for our practice. We may find ways to have more and more parts of our lives be connected with our practice. I particularly value speech practice, right? And finding ways that our communication to others can be a very crucial part of our practice. We may find ways to get guidance, both from internal sources, or maybe at this point we may look to find a teacher or a guide, someone we work with. We may work with internal guides. I mentioned last time how I like to work a lot, particularly when I'm on retreat, going down and sitting on the bench we had for my father after he died, and I would sit on that bench and talk to my father, and he would give me practice guidance. I would do that twice a day during the retreat. It was somehow accessing a wisdom being that I couldn't easily access without doing a certain kind of practice, where I would sit at the bench and say, "Hi, how are you doing? Good, how are you?" And then I'd say, "Any guidance?" And he'd say, "Keep it simple." It's very, very brief. I made a compilation of these. I made notes on what they were, and they're very, very helpful. A few days ago I got the guidance, "Keep the beautiful vision." It'd be like that, right? I remember another day it was, "Don't worry about being pretty tired today and just give yourself a lot of slack." Something like that. Very simple. And not that it would be foreign to me, but I could access it. It's a beautiful practice. And, I'll see how our time is. I was going to take us to do that kind of practice for ourselves. It's very simple. But it's making use of the imagination to get inner guidance. How many would like me to come back and give some guidance on that? Okay. Other practices, like I mentioned, taking a Sabbath day once a week where you practice more. Could be a morning, could be a whole day. I've been doing a Sabbath practice for the most of the last 30 years, one day a week. Mine are typically on Wednesdays, so which helps me keep my busy weekend social calendar intact. It's a joke. Okay. And another really interesting practice, which I've been particularly into recently, is finding during the day several times where I can have somehow 3 minutes, 5 minutes, 8 minutes of practice that I find it's helpful to ritualize them. So it could be, if you are eating on your own, to say, "I will have all meals where I eat on my own. I will do I make them practice." I do metta a lot during my meals, or you could do it for 5 minutes at a meal or 10 minutes, or you could find some way, if you have some, maybe you, one thing I mentioned, take a walk after a meal and do it, if you can, once a day, right? If you can do that. One person I work with, every day in walking from her car to work, she has to be walking meditation. I mentioned how when I was a student, I didn't have a car, I walked a lot. At a certain point I said, every moment I'm walking, I'm going to do walking meditation, right? And if you can find a few things like that, again, I think it really helps if they're ritualized, so they're not negotiable. So it's just you do it like brushing your teeth, which is hopefully not negotiable. And you, you just find yourself doing it. And when we find that we have 3, 4, 5 short periods a day to complement the, one or two times a day with sitting, it's like we come back to ourselves. We come back to presence. And I find that helps tremendously. To have it be more likely that when you're in the midst of a challenging moment, you think, "Oh, practice," right? Rather than just, we practice for a while and then the day just happens, right? And practice may be far away from our minds, right? And so these short periods really are tremendously helpful. And of course, we also, maybe at the so-called more advanced level, maybe start doing more retreats. We also, again, as we mentioned last time, we find ways to bring our practice into our families, our relationships, our work, our being part of communities, our social engagement, and so forth. Right? And we have more of a seamless sense of practice. Okay? So a few words on several of these key aspects. First, I want to talk about intentions. And much like I guided right at the beginning of the meditation, a little bit after 5:45, we can do this in a variety of ways. I think many or most of you know that intention was the most basic way that the Buddha explained karma. He said, karma, O monks, is intention, meaning that what we that with our intentions, we set in motion certain tendencies. You know, that we, if we act with the intention of kindness, we further that inclination. If we act with greed, we further that inclination. And this is actually the deeper meaning of karma. It's not so much some fatalistic sense of I did this in the morning, therefore this happened in the evening, right? It's not so much that. It's really the sense of intention. So it's a very crucial aspect of practice. And we can look at it in quite a few different ways. We can, at the beginning of a session, we can touch our deeper intention, you know, as we did earlier today. And people asked for me to say, I have a vow that I do typically 4 times a day. Which I do it 4 times a day. I've been doing it for a long time, and I may not remember it right now. We'll see. We'll see. But it's something that I've originally, a bunch of it came from a dear friend of mine who wrote me a birthday card and said, may this be what happens in the next year. And I loved it, and I made it into a vows that I took, and I've added things over the period of time. So it's a bit long. It takes a few minutes. It begins, I intend to awaken for the benefit of others. And then I go into a few moments of gratitude, just see what I'm grateful for. And then I say, may I find peace and serenity in the flow of phenomena. May my demons and dragons become allies and helpers. That's very helpful. May I fully integrate the shadow and light in my body and being. May I open ever more deeply to emptiness. May I open ever more to luminosity. May I open ever more to compassion. May I be a conduit for the Dharma to manifest on this earth. May joy always be with me. May compassion always be with me. And then I go into kind of a refuge practice in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge until enlightenment is achieved. May my virtues be of benefit to all beings. Yeah. And then I do a short practice where I imagine a wise being and merge with the energy of the wise being. So that I do typically 4 times a day. Doesn't guarantee that 5 minutes after I do it, I do something stupid. But it helps. Intention doesn't guarantee anything, but it helps. It's interesting, isn't it? Interesting practice. It keeps on helping, and it helps us connect with our priorities, and we can do those kind of touching with deeper aspirations, and we can also connect with intentions for specific activities. You know, I mentioned, you know, one of the things I do with speech practice is I have the guidelines for wise speech near my telephone, and I would sometimes go to those guidelines as I hear the phone ring, you know, or just remember it, or have them when I'm at meetings. Sometimes I would have the guidelines nearby. And some can be at a group level as well, you know. With some groups I've been part of, we've been able to have the group as a whole adopt wise speech guidelines before meetings and take 5 minutes to repeat them, right? Those are intention practices that they can be done in groups, they can be done for couples, and so forth. This accessing of intuitive guidance is a very interesting practice, and I'll just guide us briefly on this, okay? And let's see if we can do it briefly. And so for me, you know, it kind of naturally came where I do this with my father. And we can also do it by imagining a wise being. So I'll do a short experiential practice. So first, just have an image of yourself as you came into this space. You look at yourself and imagine yourself coming into this space. Bring to mind, let's say, what you had for lunch. What this is doing is just strengthening the imaginative capacity a little bit. Bring to mind what you had for lunch. And then see yourself sitting here in this room. There's a wise being who's going to come and be in front of you. And this could be a real person that you know. It could be the Buddha or Kuan Yin. It could be your grandmother who's no longer alive. Who is this wise being who has come to be here with you? And let the image of the wise being start to come into focus. And then the wise being has just one thing to say, which the wise being whispers to you. It's some guidance for, let's say, could be for the next day or for the next week. Listen for what the wise one says to you. And then the wise one and you can say goodbye for the moment, and the wise one moves away from you now, and you're left with the guidance. We can come back to being together now. And so that can be done in all sorts of variations, you know. Sometimes the wise one might give you something, a physical gift, right? You can see what that is, or might give not just one guidance, but might talk for a while, right? And so you can see what works with it, but it's really making use of the imagination that kind of goes beneath the surface, right? And imagination is magical, you know, and can really, sometimes access parts of ourselves that are hard to access otherwise. So doing something like that once a day, which doesn't take very long, that was about 3 minutes, right? Doesn't take very long. The practice I did with my father, it took 2 minutes, 4 minutes, not very long. And if you find like you're actually accessing something that's helpful, that guidance you can remember it for the whole day. That's what I would do on retreat, you know. If I would start saying, I wish I wasn't so tired, I'd go, okay, remember. And so it can really, very simple, right? I mean, a teacher could say something like that as well, but you can, this is a way you can have access yourself, right? Another really fundamental capacity as we deepen is to ground more and more in the body. I think that because this is such a mental culture, having a strong grounding in the body is very, very crucial, and it's not easy. I know for myself, I did periods of practice where I did a lot of grounding in the body practices, where I would just be with my body, you know, I'd be with my whole body as my object of attention. I think I did that for 2 years, right? And some of us are more grounded, some of us maybe are even teachers of the body, right? Might be yoga teachers or work with that. But because it's such a mental culture, being in the body is really crucial to not just being with automatic mind the whole day, right? It's really crucial. So anything which is going to further the grounding in the body is going to be helpful. Doing yoga class and really attending to the body rather than thinking how good or bad you look, helpful. You know, having all your walking be being in the body. Be in your body as you do dishes, you know, as you are, you know, doing different activities. Really, really crucial. And you can do meditations, you know, as I did, where we just attend to the body. You can do that in a retreat where you just attend to your body for a week in a retreat. It will really start to make a difference, right? You know, I feel like from my practice, something got almost like burned into my awareness. Like awareness of the body got kind of burned in from periods of practice, a lot of years of practice with the body. Buddha once said, what one thing should be developed? Mindfulness of the body. So even in a less mental culture, it was very, very important. It's what we start with in the meditation, typically. When I was first practicing with the body in an intensive way, I was working with John Travis, who was an important mentor for me for about 4 years, maybe four or five, maybe some further years. And we're probably more peers and colleagues now, but he was a teacher for me, and he's really a teacher of the body. And I remember this very powerful moment where I was complaining about not having as much support as people in monasteries would have. I think I was complaining about, oh, those Tibetan practitioners, they're in a monastery, they have so much support. And I was complaining and saying, ah. And he said to me, let your body be your monastery. I said, whoa. I think that's a big one. Right. So because if your body's your monastery, your monastery's around. You're in a monastery, so to speak. And so that I took that to heart. That was electrifying for me to hear that. And it really was a helpful guidance. And it's a very helpful guidance in practice. Just stay in your body. Come back to your body. Very, very crucial. And I'll just finish with a few words about this really important practice of taking difficulties as opportunities for practice. It changes everything when you start to be actually interested in how you get stuck, rather than having it be, oh, shucks. Or, oh, not another difficulty or not another problem, small or large. And when we actually get interested, you know, we get interested, and it can be on all sorts of levels. It can be, oh, I have a physical difficulty. Oh, let me see how I work with that, you know. And, or I have, you know, a difficulty in a relationship, or or whatever, or there's something that comes up that's quite challenging, to really take that as a starting point for inquiry. You know, I think I might have mentioned last time, I'm not sure, but I had this very interesting experience when I was, I don't think I did. It was a story from a while ago where in a past life, I was a teacher of philosophy at universities. I did it for 7 years. This is that kind of archetypal amount of time to do something like that. And towards the end of that time, there was a project which was developed out here. I was at that time living in Kentucky in rural Ohio. I was teaching at the University of Kentucky and Kenyon College, and then originally Bowling Green for 1 year. Some of you may have come from near there. And I was part of this group called Revisioning Philosophy, which was kind of started by people like Michael Murphy at Esalen. We actually met at Esalen. So it was pretty cool for me to come out from Kentucky and go to Esalen. Kind of got me out here. And, you know, people like Roger Walsh was in it, and Jacob Needleman, Susan Griffin was part of it, Houston Smith. And wonderful people. And when we started talking together, you could sense that it wasn't all fun and games. When people had different views, there was a certain edginess. And to me, as a young teacher, it didn't seem all that different from not-so-wise people getting into different problems with their views. And there was a guy named Robert McDermott. Some of you may know Robert. He became president of CIIS. And Robert made the suggestion, if you have a difference in view, take it as a starting point for inquiry, rather than as a starting point for war. And that was so great, right? And I think it helped us. I took that to heart and took that as a practice for a long time. It was wonderful, you know, and you could ask questions. What might I learn from this person? Why have I such a reaction at that person's view? You know, philosophical, spiritual, political, whatever. And it could be, you know, what can I learn from this person? What's there? What am I not seeing? Where did my view come from? And so forth. So it's taking difficulties like that and having curiosity, a sense of inquiry, with that kind of challenge and with all sorts of challenges. It starts to make our practice have a whole different depth, I think. And to the extent that we have some difficulties, a lot of opportunities to inquire. Not easy, but I think when we start taking challenges and difficulties as practice, our practice accelerates. And it's not easy. Let me just finish with another poem, just to end. You know, maybe because of time, I think I will just, maybe I won't do a beautiful poem. If we have time at the end, I'll do it. But I want to have discussion. Okay. And I'll just say, reflect now. If you had to take one area, one or two, for the next week, and make a commitment to bringing the intention to work in some way with your daily practice. Could be any things I've mentioned or many that I haven't mentioned. Just think to yourself, what would that be? If this resonates, what would I like to focus on for the next week? Thank you so much for your attention. I'll bring back the poem. I think we'll likely have time. I'll bring that back at the end if we have time. A wonderful poem that sort of brings everything together. But let me just ask, let's open it up. And I'd love to hear if there are any reports from your own practice, any questions about anything I've said, any observations, insights, really, because again, I think of this as really ultimately quite collaborative. You know, we're, if we stay with this, we will each discover ways to deepen, sustain practice that will be useful to others and that are important to share. So other, any thoughts, comments, questions? Vita, please. And then in the back, please.
Yeah. Do we need the microphone?
I'll repeat the question.
Actually,
or comment.
So what happened? So my intention this week was to do metta at meals.
Yeah.
To eat by myself. And to be in the body when I was walking.
Yeah.
Those were my intentions.
Yeah.
Okay. I also have an intention of sitting every morning.
Yeah.
And sometimes something happens, like I'll go through a period of really having my daily practice.
Yeah.
And then, like, not. And I don't know if you have any suggestions for, it's like I'm not motivated to sit. Like, why am I sitting? Like,
okay.
I know that's a little bit out of what you're talking about.
No, I think it's all relevant. It's really a question of how to find the juice going and the internal motivation for regular daily practice. And so what would help, what typically helps motivate you the most to practice?
Today I can't tell you. Last week I probably could tell you.
But I'm not saying it has to be alive right now, but generally in the last, let's say, 2 years.
I mean, I've been practicing for years.
Right.
So sometimes I guess for me, trying to live by the precepts.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a big one for me.
Living by the precepts.
I guess that's a big one for me. Sitting also is a good way to start my day. I know that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of my priorities and my ethics and how I want to live my day.
Yeah. I would suggest a few things. One is to see what motivates you in general the most to sit. And if there are certain factors, like, you know, for some it would be doing some reading, listening to a Dharma talk, talking with a friend, going into groups more often. And if there are factors like that which you know are generally helpful, then strengthen them.
And I do that. I have a Dharma buddy twice a week.
That's great. Second thing would be to, sometimes it's important, very often, you know this from retreats, or people who have done retreats know this, it's actually very important, even when you don't feel like it, just to sit for a while, and don't worry at all about the quality. Okay, that's a big one. And so that's from a meditation teacher saying, don't worry at all about the quality. I remember one of my Tibetan teachers, Mingyur Rinpoche, he used to say, zero is okay. Meaning 0% quality is okay. First of all, you know, partly that there's something just in that sitting and doing it. And if you don't do it for half an hour on the days when your motivation is least alive, do it for 10 minutes. Right? And just even if it feels like going through the motion, do that. Sometimes people find that walking, you know, can be much more enlivening than sitting. Right? But I would say do it, don't worry about the quality is a big one, and just do a little bit. Make a commitment to do at least a little bit, because it's like people who play, you know, musical instruments with the embouchure, you know, where you have muscles. And it's like if you do 5 minutes a day, it keeps it going, and if you don't, you lose the muscle tone. It's interesting, it's similar. Let me go to the back and then right here up front,
thank
please.
You.
Thanks.
Just to request to repeat your birthday card meditation.
Oh, that's very
well. You know, we're going to put this on the web, aside from the comment about Sylvia. It takes 3 minutes, I think. But if we have time, I will. But I think it'll be on the website. You know. and so we can. Okay, please.
I have a right speech talk.
Okay.
I heard you say that we could say about ourselves that we have done something stupid.
Yeah.
And to red flag the word stupid and replace it with unintelligent.
Yeah.
Because the intelligent part is always there, and I can remove the un.
Yeah.
It's interchangeable. Because I notice the children particularly can have battles with one another when that word is spoken.
Yeah, that's great. It's really, I didn't go so much into speech. There's
but rather than think stupid, we think cupid, it is loving.
Yeah. But essentially, having the mindfulness to be alert for any reactivity in the mind, including the reactivity of being judgmental towards ourselves. And if we can actually be on the lookout for anything that's reactive, meaning there's some kind of compulsive aversion or grasping, and really be alert for that, that goes so far, you know, and can be expressed in our speech. And any thought which is judgmental is by definition reactive. You know, again, we're differentiate being judgmental from being discerning. But that would take a little while to unpack, but there's a difference. But the reactivity we know from the charge, the tone of voice, right? I could say I have the same words and be either reactive or non-reactive, right? And so it's the energy, the tone, and so forth. Please, yeah.
I, when you had us do the embody conjure of someone,
yeah.
I conjured up Jack Kornfield.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, take birth. And I thought it was speaking to take in our practice in our daily life.
He said, take?
He didn't. No, the last thing was take birth. That was it.
Just what?
Take birth.
Take birth? Yeah, I thought you said that. Yeah.
And then I thought it was kind of like what you were talking about, of bringing our practice into our daily life.
Yeah.
It was pretty work. Good.
It's interesting. And sometimes what we get we might not fully understand. Mm-hmm. Or it might be like a koan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That was
cool. Yeah, but that resonated with you.
Yeah, really a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Please, yeah.
The practice that I tried to do was to deal with a difficult situation as part of my practice.
Mm-hmm.
And It just like converted it from a pain in the neck, you know, a difficult situation to, oh, okay, I can look at all the emotions that I'm having in relation to this and just be present with them as opposed to just being so upset at myself that I would be upset.
Yeah, beautiful. So bringing the intention to be with challenging situation as practice, and it sounded like it helped you to move from being more caught in the difficulty to really noticing it. Okay, there's this emotion, these thoughts, and so forth. And beautiful. It's really, that's the essence of it. Yeah, yeah. And it's like that change in perspective is subtle, and it's actually not so difficult to get to, but it's everything, right? Yeah. Other observations, please.
Yeah, I try to bring my family in various levels into my daily practice more wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
And the responses I'm getting from abroad is so not appreciated.
Yeah.
That I feel so much more grateful in my daily practice, being more free and more joyful about it.
Yeah. Yeah, so interesting, like bringing your attention into, let's say, challenging family dynamics, right? And none of these techniques are guaranteed to get certain results, right? But they're really about developing our own integrity more, or our own clarity of intention.
I'm calling for truth telling from the other side.
Yeah.
And these three brothers want me killed because I claimed my freedom 30 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like a high degree of difficulty situation. Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, so it's really, you know, if we, I think last time I was here in January for the two sessions, I think we talked about working with heart practices with difficult circumstances, particularly forgiveness and compassion. And so there's so much that can be brought to difficult situations. But I think the starting point is just seeing, as I'm hearing from you, how to have that be part of practice more. It sounds like something in you is getting freed up more. That's what I'm hearing. And they are not saying, oh, I'm so glad you're committed to your practice. maybe last one? Yeah.
I don't know. I sometimes feel the more I meditate,
yeah.
And I can meditate and do it regularly, but
yeah.
I feel like isolated and separate sometimes,
yeah.
Instead of being more part of,
yeah.
You know, because we were talking about bringing your practice into your daily life,
yeah.
But I don't seem to make that very well.
Yeah, yeah. So a sense of feeling isolated and having your practice sounds like be more on your own and just challenging to bring into daily life. I think this is something that I think is just part of the practice. Sort of an occupational hazard. And so not to worry about it. And how many here can relate to that? Okay, so look around. Okay. And maybe even talk to some of them in more depth after we finish. But I think it is challenging. Some, you know, it's many, many levels we could look at that on. You know, I think I mentioned that sometimes we find that our friends shift, you know, and we can feel more isolated. Ultimately, this is about just being present. You know, the core of this is being present to your own life and the life of others. And it's actually ultimately about connection. But it can, definitely there can be like a developmental path towards that, where it can feel isolating sometimes, where I'm just on my own. So I would suggest maybe talking to some of the people who raised their hands and maybe seeing how they worked with it. You know, and sometimes it's a matter of friend shifting. Sometimes it's a matter of being more in the body and more in the heart and not looking for anything particular to happen, but just being present. There's a lot we could say there. Okay. And I want to finish in time for the meta cards, otherwise I could give another 5 or 10 minute response. Okay. So thank you so much. It's a great question. Thanks also for, you know, it's a question in which, you know, there's some challenge and pain and vulnerability there. So I really thank you for saying it, because it really, I think a lot of people connected with that. Do we have some cards? Okay, please.
I'm looking for Diane, who had stroke surgery this week. She believes that she may work through her difficult emotional issues and be at ease. For HV, suffering from severe depression and PTSD. In memory of Carolina, who passed away recently, she was a really beautiful and happy spirit.
Thank you. So let me just close with a few pieces. One is, let me invite you to come back to your intention for the next week. And how many would like to make a commitment to deepen your practice in one or two ways in the next week, okay? Just rest with that intention. And as I mentioned last week, stating intentions publicly often strengthens them. And if you'd like to, I'll invite you just to say your intention for the next week in just a few words, just 3-4 words, in other words, briefly, so we have enough time for a few. So if you want to just speak up and say your intention, please.
I'm going to add an evening practice to my morning practice.
Adding an evening practice to morning practice. Yeah. Please.
To be mindful of my body in many, many different circumstances.
To be mindful of the body in many circumstances. Great. Please.
To use inquiry to deal with difficulties and turn them into challenges.
Yeah. To use inquiry to work with difficulties and what, open to challenges?
Yeah, open them to challenges.
And open to challenges.
I have to get there.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful. Please.
Pay attention to what my intentions are.
Yeah, to pay attention to intention.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Please.
To be in my body and conscious of my speech.
To be in my body and conscious of my speech. Great. Please.
Bring more light to my daily journaling.
Yeah. Bring more light to your daily
journaling.
Yeah. Maybe one or two more? Anyone? Please.
I'd like to hear more from my wise one.
Hear more from my wise one. That's great. Okay, I'll finish with the poem and then we'll just do a few moments of metta. This is a poem by a man named Roger Keyes. Hokusai says, anyone know Roger Keyes? He used to live in Whittacre. Does he still? Mm. Hokusai, and Hokusai is the Japanese painter, you know, who had probably most famous painting is The Wave. Hokusai says, look carefully. He says, pay attention, notice. He says, keep looking, stay curious. He says, there is no end to seeing. He says, look forward to getting old. He says, keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says, get stuck, accept it, repeat yourself as long as it's interesting. He says, keep doing what you love. He says, keep praying. He says, every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. He says, every one of us is frightened. He says, every one of us has to find a way to live with fear. He says, everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees. Wood is alive. Water is alive. Everything has its own life. Everything lives inside of us. He says, live with the world inside you. It says it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter if you saw wood or catch fish. It doesn't matter if you sit at home and stare at the ants on your veranda or the shadows of the trees and the grasses in your garden. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that you attend to the life that lives through you. So let's just sit now and invite the quality of care that the poem invoked to be present. And let that metta be in your heart. And let it start by wishing well for yourself. The sense of care for oneself as a beautiful, vulnerable being. Let that energy of the heart start to move outward, moving in front and back, left and right, the heart radiating, filling our space here with care for all of us. May we be well. May we live with love and wisdom. May we keep learning. And then let that radiating heart move beyond the boundaries of this hall, filling the space of San Rafael and going further, ultimately going in all directions without limit, covering the earth, filling the earth and going into space in front and back, above and below, left and right, the heart radiating in all directions and wishing well for all beings. And then coming back just to being present in one's body, in our room. And listening for the sound of the bell that invites the beginning of this next week of practice. Thank you for your kind attention, and I guess see you in a few months, if not before.